Welcome back to the DB course called Transforming Problems into Happiness. So my name is Eddie and I'm one of the tutors here. So as we're engaged in the practice of Dharma, it's important to be relaxed and yet be awake. So if you'd like to just adjust your posture now, make sure that your back is nice and straight and your shoulders are relaxed. You get it. Half close your eyes or keep them as they are. But while you continue to breathe normally and naturally, I'd like you to be aware of the movements that take place in your body. So each time you inhale, there'll be movements either at the abdomen or upper chest. And the same thing will happen when you exhale. And I'd just like you to become aware of those movements and feelings that take place when you inhale or exhale. And while you remain aware of the movements taking place in your body, I'd like you to imagine that the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas of the 10 directions appear in the space above you, while around you all sentient beings appear seated. And every one of these sentient beings is related to you in some way. Either as a parent, a brother or a sister, an aunt or uncle, or even child. And in these relationships, your happiness is always dependent upon their kindness. And while they too wish to be happy, just like you, they've never actually been able to achieve a stable and long-lasting happiness. They've never been able to completely avoid suffering. Never been genuinely happy. But now that the cause and conditions are present, cause and conditions that are conducive to awakening itself, form the resolve to quickly attain for them the state of enlightenment. And by doing so, turn their mind to the Dharma, to be able to practice the Dharma as a path and to remove obstacles from that path, thereby purifying their confusion into wisdom and revealing their natural birthright, the state of unchanging goodness we call Buddha nature. To help us bring about their awareness of the unchanging state, we take refuge in the families of the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas in front of us and generate the mind of enlightenment. We will say a few prayers and offer the mandala. So, taking refuge and generating bodhicitta, I go for refuge until I am enlightened to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly. By my practice of giving and other perfections, may I become a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. I go for refuge until I am enlightened to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly. By my practice of giving and other perfections, may I become a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. I go for refuge until I am enlightened to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly. By my practice of giving and other perfections, may I become a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. Now, sort of stabilizing this wish and enhancing it, we recite the four immeasurables together. May all sentient beings have happiness and the causes of happiness. May all sentient beings be free from suffering and the causes of suffering. May all sentient beings be inseparable from the happiness that is free from suffering. May all sentient beings abide in equanimity, free from attachment for friends and hatred for enemies. So to generate the path to enlightenment, we need to accumulate as much merit as possible and purify the mind of all the hindrances and obstructions. And the practices that contain purification and the accumulation of merit are all contained in the seven limb prayer. So let's recite that together. Reverently, I prostrate with my body, speech, and mind. I present clouds of every type of offering, actual and imagined. I declare all my negative actions accumulated since beginning this time, and rejoice in the merit of all holy and ordinary beings. Please remain until the end of cyclic existence and turn the wheel of Dharma for living beings. I dedicate my own merits and those of all others to the great enlightenment. We're about to make an offering to the refuge field in front of us. Now, the essence of this offering, called a mandala, is the absence of clinging. So think here, in the absence of clinging to our body, our merits and our possessions, in that absence appears a wonderful pure land where all living beings can take teachings from us, and we're offering this to the Buddha and his community in front of us. So this ground, anointed with perfume, strewn with flowers, adorned with Mount Meru, four continents, the sun and the moon. I imagine this as a Buddha field and offer it. May all living beings enjoy this pure land. Idam Guru Ratna Mandala Kamayatayami. Now the offering is accepted by the refuge field. Now the Buddha smiles at us with delight. And the families of enlightened beings begin to dissolve into light, melting into the central figure of Shakyamuni Buddha. The Buddha himself begins to decrease in size, then move through space and come to abide above the crown of our head. He descends through space, entering the crown of your head, go down into your chest, and stopping at the level of your heart. Whereby his radiance begins to increase, filling your body and mind with light. The light penetrates the pores of your skin and escapes into the 10 directions of space, filling the whole realm of space with light. And wherever there are sentient beings within space, they are touched by this light and transformed, becoming fully awakened. From the heart of each of these beings, once again, light emanates into the 10 directions of space. And as we breathe normally and naturally, feel as if there's no boundaries between your body and space. All divisions have fallen away. We relax into the great, vast, open space. Now the light begins to withdraw from the 10 directions of space, and once again entering your chest at the level of the heart. Light becomes very small, and we acknowledge this light as being symbolic of our own Buddha nature. And this is the natural potential of the mind, which is stained with obscurations, to become fully transformed into the state of Buddha. So Buddha is nowhere else but within the nature of our own mind. And we acknowledge this and are determined to awaken that potential to bring about the welfare of ourselves and every living being. And it's with that intention foremost in mind that we are engaging in our study of Dharma. So now in your own time, breathe in deeply through your nostrils. Exhale through your mouth. Allow your eyes to flutter open if they're closed, and bring your awareness once again to the front of your screen. And I'll now open up the share and we'll begin our lesson. So you can see here we're up to class 8 of the unit called Transforming Problems into Happiness. And we've covered a lot of material. We've covered all of these topics here, anger and its faults, transforming problems, experiencing problems for others, changing our attitude through the practice of tonglen, or giving and taking. We've also gone through the 7 verses of the 8 verses of thought transformation. And these 7 verses have all dealt with the method aspect of the mind of enlightenment. In the first verse, we learned how to cherish others. In the second, we learned how to enhance the mind that cherishes others. And a way of doing that was work against the sense of false pride that we have. The third verse described the afflictions and what we needed to do to get rid of them, and also one of the best ways to do that is to develop equanimity. Verse 4 taught us how to extend and deepen our compassion. And it also showed us what really stops us doing that, which was anger. Verse 5, we learned how to extend and deepen love through the transformation of problems, and we had to work against envy. Verse 6 showed us how to voluntarily endure suffering and the practice of patience. And last week we looked at the 7th verse, where we were taught how to change our attitude through the practice of giving and taking. And the essence of the giving and taking practice is the development of courage in the face of suffering. Now, tonight we're going to be looking at the 8th verse, and in the 8th verse it's primarily about the wisdom aspect of bodhicitta, in other words the emptiness. But that's the main part of tonight's lesson, but before we enter that we're going to have a look at some of the the faults of attachment and how to take happiness as the path. Now, there's 2 books up here called Arya Davis' 400 Stanzas on the Middle Way and Practical Ethics, Profound Emptiness. These two books are the best books you could read on the overcoming of attachment. They're not hard to read. In fact, they're very easy to read, but the advice is dynamite. All of the other books really have to do with this eighth verse, but also, like for instance, in Praise of Great Compassion, there's also some material in there, and Transforming the Heart, there's also material in there, about how to take happiness onto the path. There are other books by Lama Zopa Rinpoche, which are just fantastic, also about this topic. So, you know, sort of see the shortcomings of attachment and selfish, affectionate desire. So I really like this term because it, when you put it into a, when you break it down, I forget what you call this, it becomes SAD, sad, selfish, affectionate desire. But that's what we normally call romantic love.
It's an acronym, hun.
An acronym. Thank you, Miffy. Yeah, so the acronym of romantic love is, you know, sad, meaning selfish, affectionate desire. We'll also look at, like I said, taking happiness as the path. The real essence of this is, once again, in the giving and taking meditation, when we give away everything that we hold dear, our happiness and the causes of it to others. And verse 8, which is really about maintaining the purity of the practice. Now, when we come to verse 8, it's, there's many ways that it's been translated. So I'm just going to read you one to sort of put in place the foundation. So this verse is, furthermore, through all these method practices, that means, you know, the previous seven verses, through all these seven method practices, together with a mind undefiled by stains of conceptions of the eight extremes, and it sees all phenomena as illusory, may I be released from the bondage of mistaken appearance and conception. So I really like this one because it really spells out what this verse is about, whereas many other times it's not so obvious. And in fact, the verses we'll be actually using in this class are the ones where it's not so obvious. So that's why I thought I'd just say it. So I'll say it once again. Furthermore, through all these method practices, together with a mind undefiled by stains of conceptions of the eight extremes, and it sees all phenomena as illusory, may I be released from the bondage of mistaken appearance and conception. So let's begin now by looking at the shortcomings of attachment and selfish, affectionate desire. So, in general, attachment is a mistaken mind because it's overestimating the qualities of the objects that are appearing to that mind. The qualities seem to be coming from the side of the object. And there are great harms that can come to ourselves and to others when we do not know that that's what's going on. So when we get involved with desirous attachment, all these sort of things can happen to us. We can lose our ability to reason. Our relationships can be destroyed. We can harm ourselves and others. Friends distrust you. It actually destroys compassion. When the desire of attachment is not met, the mind transforms into anger and hatred. It also leads to... So now I want to talk to you about, because what usually happens to us is that we mistake desirous attachment for love. So I want to talk to you a little bit about the word love and what it means in the Buddhist context. So there's a great text called The Path of Purification, and in it It describes love as having the aspect of friendliness as its characteristic. Its function is to promote friendliness. It is manifested as the disappearance of malice and annoyance. And its proximate cause is seeing others as lovable. When it succeeds, it eliminates malice. When love fails, it degenerates into selfish, affectionate desire. So love views one, many, or all beings as lovable and wishes them well. This love does not seek anything for ourselves. The pleasure is in the loving. This type of love is strong and not fickle, according to either our mood or how others treat us. It is ready to help, but does not have an agenda or coerce others to fulfill our expectations. Now, many movies, novels, and other art forms deal with romantic and sensual love. From a Buddhist viewpoint, this emotion should more accurately be called desirous attachment, as it is generally based on exaggerating someone's good qualities or projecting excellent qualities that aren't present. Attachment also gives way to emotional neediness and possessiveness that lead to making demands or having high expectations of the other.
So
love, and especially immeasurable love, is free from these complications.
So I'm just looking at this picture of the guy burning up and thinking about that terrible murder-suicide that happened just, you know, two streets away from Lungri Tangpa Centre at the end of last year, where the husband, burnt his wife and two children in the car and then killed himself.
Yep.
So many marriages are based on this, desirous attachment that seems okay in the beginning, but it ends up being something as violent and horrendous as that.
Yeah, and this is what I was saying at the beginning when the desire within attachment is not met, it can turn to anger and hate and to even taking the lives of those, we say we love, like that man did with his wife and children. So I hope, those of you who are listening can see there's a really big difference here between what Buddhism means by love and what we have probably been brought up to believe it is in our country and culture.
Yeah, well, the where you mentioned about seeing the other as lovable and warmth and good-heartedness and kindness developing is quite different from marriages based on just attraction and all the, the bachelorette and whatever that we're fed on television.
Yeah, well, it's like, exaggerating their good qualities or projecting excellent qualities on them that aren't there. So I also like this thing that this love has the aspect of friendliness. Now, so some people, when you start relationships, it can start off as friends, and then it goes beyond that. But hopefully within the relationship that friendliness remains. But oftentimes, like I said, it can be shunted into the background through this exaggeration process.
And the expectations of the happiness coming from the other person.
Other person, that's right. So just to finish this off, combining the understanding of selflessness with love demolishes any sense of possession. So what it's getting at here is that when you look for yourself, a real self that has the affectionate desire for the other, you don't find a real self. You don't find any person like that there. So you are selfless. That type of person is not there. And so you go, okay, that's not there. And yet I can still have the aspect of friendliness towards the other person. The person I really thought that did exist, who I think I really am, I'm not actually that person. That type of person does not exist. Yet I do exist. And I can have friendliness towards this other person. I can extend a sense of friendliness and concern to the other person.
So Pauline's saying that, you know, when our common relationships go wrong, it's like a grandiose delusion, and this can be really scary.
Yep, that's right. That's right. And you find yourself, you know, like this picture here, in a type of hell.
And Uri's saying a little bit like the happy ever after fantasy.
So once again, there is no independent soul or essence in a person to love or to be loved. Now, you gotta think about this, because when you say that you love someone, you're not saying, I love your mind, I love your body. You're saying, I love you. Now, that you is not in the body, and it's not in the mind, and it's not the mind and the body itself, and it's not a possessor independent of that body and mind. That's definitely not the person. And yet for most of us, that's the person who we think we love. Well, there's no person there like that. That's what we sort of get to get used to. So there is a person there, that there is a person that we love, but they're not, like I said, they're not somewhere inside the body and mind, possessing a body and mind. And they're not the body and mind singular or together. That's not the person. So that can help you hugely. You know, it can really put a dampener on that type of desirous attachment, but also on the anger that comes about when your expectations aren't met. There's no independent soul or essence in a person to love or to be loved. The highest love wishes beings to have the highest happiness and will show others the path to the end of suffering, the path realized and taught by the Buddha. So now, you know, this sense of friendliness that we have towards others, and the type of happiness we can develop in dependence upon that, we can use it on the path. In many ways, it's a bit more difficult than using suffering. Suffering is, we're all prepared to use suffering on the path, and we'll make a lot of effort to do so. But when it comes to happiness, it's as if we sort of don't know how you do that. We sort of keep our happiness. And so there's a sort of self-cherishing there, a sense of a miserliness. And it's like, it's my happiness. You've made me happy, and so you should, and I am, and it's mine. We have to sort of let go of that clinging to what we call happiness, and make happiness part of our path. And we can do that by through the practice we call giving by means of love. So this is, of course, the second step in the Tonglen practice, whereby first we take the suffering and then we give happiness. Now, the idea behind that, or the point of the practice, is to release the attachment we have to our own body, our possessions, our virtues, and our happiness. And not only to detach ourselves from them, but also to offer them sincerely for the service of others. So, you know, we start with our mother or a very close friend. Then we do somebody who's still close, but a little less close. So we finally end up finding that we're giving it all, our happiness away to strangers. Then is to the difficult people, the harm doers. And then it's, you know, the different types of animals. And then you go to the different realms. And finally, it's all beings all together. And in relationship to this practice, the practice of the eight verses of thought transformation, what we can give here is all the merit that we've accumulated in the doing of those practices. So that, in other words, our merit, right? So and you can look at merit here as being sort of like the spiritual energy that we've developed through, in the first verse, cherishing others. In the second verse, humility. Third, equanimity, patience, joy, patience again, courage, and this verse coming up, our wisdom. So every time we breathe out, we can breathe out these qualities. So all of these good qualities are contributory to us having a good rebirth, to us having happiness in future lives. They're also the basis for happiness in this life. So we release our clinging to them by imagining that we are giving them away through visualization practices. And of course, you know, we can also be humble in the face of difficulties, be patient, be joyous, and so forth. So that way, once again, we sort of take happiness as the path. Okay, so I'm going to stop here, and now we're going to go on to the actual verse and really look at the aspect of wisdom in this practice. But before I do, does anybody have any final questions?
Well, there hasn't been any questions so far.
Okay. Well, if you think of some later on, folks, just write them in, put them into Miffy, and we'll come back to them, you know, when we finish this bit. So let's have a look at the verse now. So here it is. It says, by ensuring that all this remains undefiled from the stains of the eight mundane concerns, and by understanding all things as illusions, I will train myself to be free of the bondage of clinging. So here, this first, in the first line, it says, by ensuring that all this. So all this refers to the previous seven verses and the practices that we've done there, you know, the practice of cherishing others, humility, equanimity, patience, joy, and so forth. So all of those, these practices, these qualities we've developed to remain undefiled, meaning we don't want to misapprehend them and think that these qualities are truly existent, that they're not inherently existent and so forth. We don't want to defile them with a wrong consciousness. And so what? So it's undefiled from the stains of the eight mundane concerns. So here it's as if, you know, like I say, the mind is, the ordinary mind is stained by the previous way we've looked at things and related to things, so that things actually do appear as if they were truly existent, when in fact they're not. And this is what the word illusion refers to, something that's looking true but it's false. So we have to sort of be able to identify that illusory nature of the phenomena and then train oneself not to cling to them as if they were real. Now we come back to this term again, stains, these stains, undefiled from the stains. So this term can be used in three different ways. The first way, which is the way we'll be talking about it tonight, is the practices being done free from the wrong conception of holding things to be truly existent. That's one way, this, you know, the meaning undefiled, being free from the wrong idea that whatever phenomena I'm dealing with, they are actually truly existent. We want to be free from that. So that's one way, and that's why we'll be talking about it shortly. The second way is how we talk about being, we want to be free from the attachment to this life. And that's how it's most often explained.
And Eddie, that one seems much more doable than the first one, which, you know, just permeates everything.
Yeah, that's right. And that's why, you know, that one is done at the very beginning of the path. I think we might have done it in our first or second class in this module. You know, so then we're talking about the conventionally existing things that we can bring praise or blame to, that we, you know, wish to gain and we don't want to lose, that sort of thing. And they're to do with just this life. There's another way too they can also be spoken of, and that's in relationship to being free from self-cherishing. So I haven't come across a teaching on that yet, but the other two I have. So in a number of different books, it's not often that you come across a text where the teacher explains it from the point, the first one, you know, undefiled from the stains or from the practices being done, free from the wrong conception of holding things to be truly existent. You don't come across that very often. But His Holiness the Dalai Lama has explained it like that and conjoined it with, you know, in relationship to that grasping at things to be truly existent, we keep ourselves attached to the pleasures of this life. So we sort of conjoin them.
Eddie, so those two things really go together all the time, don't they?
Because we
automatically grasp at things to be inherently existent, then we're just completely obsessed by them.
Yeah, that's right. Then we have the more common eight mundane concerns, eh? Those things we want and those things we don't want.
And that's where all the fairy tales about success and love and everything come into play.
That's right. And all the disturbing emotions arise, you know, in response to that. That's right. Yeah. It's, you know, like the root of it is this wrong way of seeing things, you know, the stains. So today's teaching, undefiled from the stains, is going to be explained from the point of view as practices being done free from the wrong conception of holding things to be truly existent. To remain undefiled refers to the wisdom of meditative equipoise that directly realizes emptiness. So the direct realization of emptiness is the first completely non-mistaken awareness or undefiled mind. So you can see now, for us, probably all of our minds are defiled because we've never had a direct comprehension of emptiness. So this points out another very interesting thing, which is something it's very, very useful to hold on to. So that is that every conventional consciousness that we have, so in other words, our visual awareness, auditory awareness, olfactory awareness, taste awareness, all those conventional minds, as well as the normal thinking mind, whatever objects they engage with is going to be engaged with in a mistaken way, so that consciousness will be wrong. Not every one of them. This is something very useful to remember. And nevertheless, there is a way to free the mental consciousness, so that it is no longer wrong. And this is what they say, so it can be undefiled, get rid of that defilement. And that's the only time, so we have, they talk about, if you have a valid mental consciousness, you have to say the wisdom realizing emptiness, that's valid. Every other one is not. So it's a lovely division, isn't it? It's quite simple.
Right? I've got to make sure it's not too demoralizing.
It's just the way it is. It's not just us, it's any being with a consciousness. Animals have it, insects have it, humans have it.
And then because we all have that wrong consciousness, then we all suffer.
Yeah, that's right. Because we don't know it's wrong. We think it's true. But what it's showing us is truly the way things are. That's why they often call grasping at true existence, because it's not true. It's actually false. So our conventional consciousnesses are all false.
Can we have an analogy of this, like when the scientists talk about atoms and things,
Okay. So in the beginning of science, and even they even present this in the Buddhist paths too, that we start where we are. And that means that things have an objective appearance. Now, they are the objects that we engage in. So if we're here and the world is all around us, and the world is independent of us, and we believe it to be so. And right up until like the early 1900s, that's how science operated. There's a world out there, and we just need to understand it. But in the early 1900s, a number of different scientists discovered that the world actually was not like that. That in fact, the world exists dependent upon us. If there is an independent world, if the world exists independently of us, we can never actually know it. What's that type of science called, please, Miffy?
Are you talking about quantum physics?
Yeah, quantum physics. Yeah. Right? So, and the type of physics before that was called?
Newtonian physics.
Yeah, Newtonian physics. So Newtonian physics is a world independent of us. Things have objective existence. And it was thought that that was true. So, in other words, phenomena truly exist. They are existing in the way they are appearing to us, which is independent of our senses and so forth. But like I said, in the early 1900s, this was discovered to be false. And we have a new type of science called quantum physics. And in fact, some of the great quantum physics, one of the great quantum physicists who said to the Dalai Lama, I don't know how you came to understand this when you don't study quantum physics. Just recently. And I said, well, Nagarjuna taught this 2,000 years ago, or not 2,000, 800 years ago, 900 years ago. That things do not have the objective existence they appear to have. That's the illusion. So I need to train myself to be free of clinging to that idea that things are actually independent of us and having their own entity. So just the direct realization of emptiness is the first completely non-mistaken awareness or undefiled mind. Until we realize emptiness directly, all our minds are mistaken awarenesses, because due to the imprints of self-grasping or true grasping ignorance, their objects appear as inherently existent. Geshe Langri Tangpa calls these imprints stains of the eight mundane concerns. So it's just that, you know, like we've been habituated for it for so long that we actually think the way things appear to us is actually true. So I want to bring up some of these terms now, because they're very, very useful in terms of understanding how things appear to us and how they actually don't exist in that way, which is getting at this idea of emptiness. So we have the stains, and on one side I'm going to put the wrong idea, the wrong conception, and the language that's used for it, and then what it means. So here we have the term truly existent, and it means existing in the way it appears to us. So if things appear to be objective, to exist objectively, they exist that way. If they appear independent of our senses, they are and do exist independently of our senses. And this means we like true, it's true. It looks this way, it's true. It looks this way, I believe it, it's true.
Okay, so we don't even know that we are having an appearance. We just think the appearance is true.
That's right. Yeah. So, you know, like, for instance, like if you thought, for instance, if you look at anything around you, you will see that it doesn't appear to change. So if you thought, okay, that it doesn't change, then this thing has got true existence. It's not appearing to change, so it exists that way. It's not changing. So a lot of people will take this idea about relationships, right? You get married, or you have a relationship for whatever, you know, the ideas you have, and you expect them to stay the same. You want them to stay like this. You know, like why I'm engaged, it's like this. That's why I'm here. And it doesn't. It doesn't exist that way. It doesn't. It appears stable, but it's actually existing in a really unstable manner. The second term is inherently established or inherently existent, which means it's not dependent on anything. All the words on the wrong conception, although they use different words, they all mean the same. There's no difference in their meaning. So to be truly existent, inherently established, and then other two terms I'll show you, they all mean the same thing. But, you know, on the other side, the way it's described is slightly different. And that's to help us a bit. So if something is inherently established, in other words, inherently it means independent, not depend upon anything. Not dependent or independent. That's what it sort of means. It looks independent of us.
So inherent, like if something has inherent qualities, it means its qualities that it has, not dependent on other things.
That's right.
Okay.
Yep. Third one, existing from its own side. So this means, so like if you use Biffy's example, something has, like a person, has these really good qualities. The qualities exist from the side of the person. The person has them. This would mean that these qualities can be found either within the body or the mind of the person. Because the body and the mind are the bases of designation for a person. So the qualities are there. But if you look in there, you won't find they're not there. You don't find them there. They're not there. And this applies to all of these things. So that's why it's really good to become familiar with these terms. And well, I guess why I made the slide up, so you can call upon it when you need to. Miffy?
So Pauline has a question here that's quite relevant to this one, that what if two people are looking at the same object but they have two different views of it.
That's
Does that mean that the view that they have is coming from their mind?
That's right. That's right. And then that shows you how things do not exist in the way they appear to you. They are. What you see is there's not independent. It's dependent upon each person and what they're saying in their mind. That's right. And what they're seeing is not there. It's actually coming from the mind. The designator is the subject, the mind.
So but when we're doing that, we have no idea. What we end up doing is having an argument with the person going, no, I'm right, no, I'm right.
That's right, that's right. And this is why, this is like the basis from where all the arguments and wrong ideas come from. And we don't even know it. Now, that's what's called ignorance, not knowing, but believing you do. Now, the last one is, by way of its own character. So this is Pauline was saying, we're both arguing about, one of us saying, no, this is really good about it. The other goes, no, this is what's really good about it. That's not good. So we're looking at the object, and it seems to have its own character of the goodness. And it seems to be, there, to be found amongst the bases of designation. And actually, there's no need for us to be calling it, to impute the goodness, to even think of it or give it a name. It looks like it's already there.
So this is how some political fanatics look at their politicians.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. That's right. Now, these terms... Remember, we're doing this with every type of phenomena. Our conventional awarenesses are doing this all the time. So that means we can discover this actually going on. Look, just turn around, look at things, and then see if it looks like it's doing any of these things, the appearance, right? Is it existing? It appears to exist in the way it appears. It doesn't seem to be dependent. Can be found amongst the bases of designation. Like I did this one day, I was in the bath having a shower and I had the window open. I could see the green on the leaves on the tree out there. And I'm looking at it going, geez, it really looks like there's green on the leaves. But that would mean that the green of the leaf is existing in the leaf. Right? The green should be found amongst the bases of designation. So the basis of designation for the leaf is the shape and the term called the leaf. There should be green in there, but there's not. Now get anyone to look for the green in the leaf, you will not find it. It's not there.
Well, I mean, it's funny, especially about colour, because with colour, the way, the light rays bounce off and everything, actually every colour's in that leaf except green.
That's right. So how's the green there? Well, it's getting there through imputation by thought and name. We think it's there. It appears to us to be there. We think it's there. We say it's green. That's how it's there. So it doesn't exist by way of its own character. And it can't be found amongst the bases of designation because it's not there from its own side.
And if we're colorblind, then, we don't have the right dependent arisings to even be able to see green.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. It won't happen.
So Pauline said, how do we ever survive in this crazy world?
Well, we've got this thing called conventional truth, Pauline, where we just agree that things are a particular way. And then, but it doesn't mean to say they are that way. That's basically how. But of course, there's the odd person who disagrees, and then what usually happens, you stick them up on a cross or you hang them. Because they're big troublemakers, aren't they? They're wrong. Right. Anyway, I better move on. But like I said, like, if you can get your head around this and then start using the terms and then start looking at things. Because like I said, you know, all of this, if we wish to discover the lack of inherent existence, we have to know what inherent existence is. Now, that's the emptiness of it. We need to find that things are empty of true existence, empty of inherent existence, empty of existing from its own side, empty by way of its own character. You get any of those, you've got the emptiness. Right? So these four wrong ways of the way things are, it's wonderful because it's appearing right in front of us all the time. So something is not there. Now we can discover that not there. And then we've got the emptiness, so at least we get a correct conceptual understanding, but because it appears to be there, that's the illusion. There's an illusion going on here. The things appear to be truly existent when in fact they're not. So if we can get that, you know, sort of into us, it can actually stop grasping at them as if they were truly existent or inherently established or existing from their own side. You know, one of the things I put down here on the page to say to you, use the idea that wealth appears to be good, so it is good. Or a beautiful person appears to be a good person, so they are. And it sounds that I heard sometimes appear to be true and good, but other times they're bad. And the goodness and the badness seems to be in the sound. Color and shape, it's the same again. And then the idea that suffering appears to be bad in itself. So it's not good. And happiness appears to be good in itself. Right? So it can't be bad. If you start playing around with this, it will really, make you hesitant about believing what you're engaging with.
So you kind of develop a habit of taking appearances with a pinch of salt.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, appearances are not true. That's what you want to get out. Dude, the appearances are not true. They're all false. They all appear to be true, but they're not. In fact, they give the example of the text of somebody who appears to you to be your true friend. But in reality, they're having an affair or they're stealing all your wealth. They're doing bad stuff to you. But you don't know that. You think they're good. They're my friend. No? So they're actually existing in one way, but they're appearing in another. And all phenomena are like that. They appear to exist in one way, but they don't actually exist that way. They exist differently. So here are these eight worldly concerns. So all of these phenomena here will appear to exist inherently or intrinsically. And when we cling to them as if they were, then all the problems come. They're not problems in themselves, but as soon as you grasp them to be inherently existent or truly existent, immediately your mind is not going to, is either going to hate it or be displeased with it or really like it. So it's not the objects that are really the problem here, it's the clinging to them as if they were truly existent, inherently established. Existing in this way from their own side, by way of their own character and so forth. That's the problem, right? The wrong idea and clinging to it, believing in this wrong idea. That's the problem. So we come to this next term. You know, in the verse it says that by understanding all things to be illusory or like illusions, So like I said before, yeah, if we just use the word here, true existence, with the understanding, of course, all the other terms, it all means the same thing. They're just different ways of looking at it. So the meaning of true existence is a phenomena, you know, oneself or anything else, that exists in the way it appears to us. Now, if we just take the self, for instance, the self, if you look at somebody else, another person, where is their self?
Well,
probably think it's what?
I mean, you know, obviously I think their self is out there, but upon reflection, their self can only actually be the image in my mind.
Yeah, and you see, you know, like the image in your mind is an image of permanence. It's not subject to causes and conditions.
Yeah.
So that's another thing about why the person appears stable and always the same. Because you're actually dealing with the images in your own mind.
Yeah, because when you go to a school reunion and you see everybody and you look at their faces and go, what's wrong with them? All their faces are droopy.
Yeah, that's right. Because we've been... We actually, the actual appearance is the inner appearance to mind, the conceptual appearance. But yeah, if somebody says, well, we're out, you know, like I want to talk to you the person, who am I talking to? Is it their mind you're talking to? Say, no, I'm talking to you, the person. Well, when it's like that, then the person can only be the body, or the mind, or something that's not either of those, but something that owns them or possesses them. Or it's both the body and mind.
So this is totally cracking me up, because when someone rings up and says, oh, hello, who am I talking to?
That's right. Then you should say, well, my name is Miffy.
Oh, no, I am called Miffy.
That's right. People call me Miffy. But the convention is, Miffy. So here to explain the meaning of illusory. So true existence appears in the aspect of various objects, wherever or when and whenever they are manifest. But in fact, there's no true existence there. True existence appears, but there is none. It's an illusion. So even though everything that exists appears to be truly existent, it is without true existence. It lacks true existence. It is empty of the true existence it seems to have. To see that objects are empty of true existence, that even though true existence appears there is none, it's illusory, one has to have a definite understanding of the meaning of emptiness. Now, the meaning of the emptiness of the manifest appearance. So we have to, that's not, you can never get that by just having the thing appear to your senses. You have to sort of come at it conceptually with thinking and break the thing down until you go, it's impossible, it can't have it. It looks like it's got it, but it doesn't have it. So here I've used this example of the mirage, because the mirage is a really good example. So a mirage, like the one here you see, appears to be water, but it's not. So there's an appearance of water, but there's no water there. When we understand the reality that what we are seeing is an optical illusion caused by the atmospheric conditions, we still see water, but we know that's an illusion. That's illusory. So we will still see, a person will still appear to us to be either inside their body and mind possessing it, or is the body and mind. That still appears to us. But we have to know that's an illusion. Just like we can know here, that's an illusion. There's no water there. Though water appears there, but there is no water there. So a person appears there, but there's no true person there. That's not true. Do you get it?
Yep.
Okay, let's go on to the next one. So, I like this picture because it's like, what?
So, Pauline was saying, you know, it's a common problem that in relationships we're constantly making adjustments because our minds are changing, our opinions, their minds, their opinions are changing.
That's right.
And Uri's asking, so does this mean our lives are just one ongoing illusion?
Oh, well, yes, Uri, as long as you understand illusion being the illusion of true existence.
Right, so not the illusion of things all together, but the illusion of
true existence. No, so it's not like there's nothing there. There's a person there. Our lives exist, but they don't truly exist. That's the illusion.
Yep, that's good.
Okay. So it says here that, so this is once again from His Holiness the Dalai Lama. He says, perceiving all phenomena as illusory is one method to prevent the eight worldly concerns from contaminating our mind. Before we can see all phenomena to be like illusions, we must realize that they are empty of inherent existence. Now, the realization of emptiness does not come about through repeating this particular verse in our mind or chanting empty, empty while imagining nothing.
I'm glad he spelt that out.
Yeah. To develop a genuine insight into emptiness, we must employ reasoning to investigate how the phenomena exist. So one of the most effective and convincing ways to understand that everything is empty of inherent existence is to contemplate dependent arising and interdependence. A unique quality of this approach is that it enables us to find the middle way between total non-existence and independent or inherent existence. By understanding that things are dependent, we know they are not independent. Since independent existence and inherent existence are synonyms, we then know that they lack inherent existence. However, things are not totally non-existent because they exist dependently. If you contemplate in this way, you will not be lost in either absolutism or nihilism and will generate the correct view. It is once we gain insight into emptiness in our meditation, there is a new quality to our interactions with the world and the people in it. This is due to our awareness of the illusory nature of veil objects we encounter in daily life. With an understanding of both the empty and the illusory natures of persons and phenomena, we can work with compassion to skillfully lead others on the paths so that they too will be free from the unsubdued mind of afflictions and karma and will experience the joy and peace of full awakening. So one of the things I like to say here is this, you know, this constant appearance of things being truly existent or existent from their own side or inherently existent or existing by being established by their characteristics. All of these are also have to do with karma, because it's the habitual way that these things have been appearing to us, and we have habitually believed them to be true. Every response we've done, every habitual response we've made, is as if what's appearing to us is true. And so the mind has been stained by this habit. And it's our job to get rid of those the stains by, first of all, holding back on the belief that these phenomena are true.
It's Eddie, it's a very nice way to put it, that our mind has been stained by that habit. It also kind of stops the whole then the habit of self-blame of like, I'm such an idiot that I can't see things how they are.
Yeah. So, you know, like with this picture that's in front of you. Yeah, so I'm looking at it, and what's happening to me, it constantly flips and flips. First I see just the man's face looking down to the woman's hair. Then I look up, and it's the woman's face looking at the back of the man's neck. And there's no way I can stop that. It just keeps appearing.
But isn't there the thing that happens, the grasping it, but which one is it really?
That's right. So then you can have the grasping or the clinging, you know, that it's this or it's that. And you can just see how the mind makes up these things, this and that.
So there's been enormous internet arguments about things like this on social media.
Yep.
The blue dress, the white dress.
Yeah. Well, I better move on. And so this year, once again, so here he says, furthermore. So once again, it's the same verse, but just written differently. Furthermore, through all these method practices, together with the mind undefiled by stains of conception of the eight extremes, and it sees all phenomena as illusory, may I be released from the bondage of mistaken appearance and conception. So here we're talking about these different types of extremes. Whoopsie. So in general, there are two extremes, the extreme of existence and the extreme of non-existence. So everything that does exist is actually free from those two extremes. So this slideshow, for instance, the one you're looking at, is free from the extreme of existence because it does not exist inherently. So that's the extreme of existence, that things exist inherently. That's an extreme. So remember what that means? It means it does not depend upon anything. This slide does not depend upon anything. Because that is the meaning of inherent existence, not dependent. But you can see, can't you, just looking at it, that it depends upon a whole lot of different things, doesn't it? So this slide is free from the extreme of inherent existence, because it doesn't exist inherently. But it's also free from the extreme of non-existence, because it's existing right there. It's a conventional existence where we can see it. We can relate to it. I've just read out the words and so forth. So it's not like non-existent. It exists. So these, so we say that extremes of you know, existence, these two extremes, one is inherent existence and the thing of taking something that does exist to not exist. And most people veer towards the extreme of existence, thinking that if something does exist, it must exist inherently. Therefore, exaggerating the way in which things exist without being satisfied with the understanding that they exist in the mere name.
Yeah, so Eddie, what usually happens, we're satisfied with just things, you know, with grasping at inherent existence until we start thinking about it, and then we flip over to the opposite and get That's all right. nihilistic.
Yeah, so this will happen a lot with you, which are here. Sometimes the things that you say, Uri, and for me too, for all of us, right? It's, if it's not inherently existent, it's non-existent. There's the two extremes. So if you find your mind doing that, you'll know, geez, I've just flipped off to one of the extremes. So this verse also has a lot to do with a thing called ultimate bodhicitta. And when we... In other words, ultimate bodhicitta, in general, is just like the wisdom realizing emptiness. But it's, we can differentiate it because it's actually the emptiness of the mind that seeks to become enlightened for the benefit of others. That's the ultimate nature of the mind that seeks to become enlightened for the benefit of others, is that it is empty. So, you know, you cannot just have emptiness out there floating in space. There has to be some sort of phenomena that is empty. So here we have bodhicitta. The mind of enlightenment is empty. A way to In other words, so we can take, first of all, like looking at the emptiness of our own body. Right? So we can do that without the mind of enlightenment. We can do that just because we're interested in it. So that's not ultimate bodhicitta. We have this mind of bodhicitta that is empty, examining the emptiness of our body. We have the mind of enlightenment, which is empty, examining the emptiness of our own eye, of our own mind, the eight extremes, conventional ultimate and the union of the two truths. When you, if you start going through these objects here, right, to discern their emptiness, once you see that they are empty of inherent nature, intrinsic existence, all those things, it's very difficult. I mean, that's easy compared to answering the question. If somebody says, yeah, well, how do they exist? You've just told me how they don't exist, and that's all very well, but how do they exist? Then it becomes very difficult.
So Eddie, Pauline's just said that she's read somewhere the only thing that we don't get attached to existing in a solid way is something like a rainbow, because we know it's appearing briefly, you know, it depends on the angle that the light falls and things. So is that one way that we can start thinking about, well, how do things exist?
Yeah, well, they use that example, you know, like illusions, like a rainbow, like a reflection in water. And actually, yeah, the rainbow one is terrific, especially when you apply that to your own mind. That the appearances arising in your mind, because that's where they all arise, they're not like out there. They are conceptual or perceptual, right? That's the appearance. And like it's like a rainbow. Right? It comes out of the empty nature of the mind, it displays itself as an appearance, and it vanishes. You're like, well, you know, where do the rainbows go? They don't go anywhere, do they? Where do the rainbows come from? They don't come from anywhere. All the thoughts that we have are just like rainbows that you see in space. You know, when it comes to describing how things, excuse me, how they do exist, we come across the term in a name only, or in mere name. And when we say that, what it's doing, the word like merely, indicates something being cut off. And what's being cut off is all those other ways of existing, inherently, objectively, intrinsically, from their own side, all those things. So it's not that. So we say in mere name. So we're not saying there's no meaning to things other than their names, or that the meaning, what it cuts off is that it exists by something other than the power of name. So, you know, if you think back to when you gave birth to a child, or when a child was first there, it doesn't have a name yet. But as soon as you give it the name, now it exists as that. So it exists in mere name. Right? Suppose you name your child Joanna. There is no part of the skin that is Joanna. There is no part of the mind that is Joanna. Joanna's not in there. So how does she exist? In name. Right? That's everything's like that. There's all these, you know, we call cause and conditions, the parts, and we give them the name. And that's their identity. And their identity is not in the parts or in the causes or the combination of the causes. It's not on them, it's not in them. Yet it is that thing. How? In name. So this goes for mind, your own name, bodies, minds, planets, universes, everything. Everything's got a name. And it depends on that name and like a consciousness that apprehends the object and then gives it the name. So, gee, I don't do this. Let's go down and have a look at these eight extremes. So, there's a very good commentary on this in one of Nagarjuna's texts, where they go through this. But today I'm just going to take these three, the produced phenomena, singularity, and the plurality. So, remember here, so things are produced and so forth. Things do come about cessation. There are impermanent phenomena, everything. So what's really going here about extreme is meaning that these phenomena inherently exist. That's the extreme. That produced phenomena inherently exist. Phenomena to say that's come to an end, that's permanent, blah, blah, blah. That's inherently existent. So we only have a few more minutes to go, so I better go through this. So look first, the extreme of produced phenomena. So anything that arises from causes and conditions is a produced phenomena. Right? A produced phenomena exist depend upon causes and conditions, and those causes and conditions are impermanent. They are subject to change. So in other words, in the phenomena itself is subject to change, because what produced it is subject to change. However, due to our familiarity with self-grasping ignorance, whenever we see a produced phenomena, we grasp it as being truly established. And this is what we mean by grasping at the extreme of produced phenomena. The extreme of produced phenomena is actually referring to inherently produced phenomena. So for us, the fact that a thing is produced seems to demonstrate that it is truly or inherently existent. But the opposite is the case. If something were inherently existent, it would exist through its own power without depending upon anything else. But a produced phenomena is dependent upon causes and conditions, and therefore lacks inherent existence. If all the necessary causes and conditions come together, clouds or rainbows appear. If those causes and conditions are absent, clouds and rainbows cannot form. The clouds and the rainbows are completely dependent upon causes and conditions for their development. Without these, they have no power to develop. And the same is true of mountains, planets, bodies, minds, and every other produced phenomenon. Because they depend on factors outside themselves for their existence, they are empty of inherent or independent existence and are mere imputations of the mind. That's not truly established. It actually exists independent upon the mind, the imputation of mind, and the name. So here's interesting too. You know, so when we have like, when we say things are imputed to the mind, to like conception. So we go, you know, we ask, what the heck does that mean? So imputed means to be, another term for it is labeled. It means added to. Something is added to it. That's the process of imputation, adding to something. So what's happening with us is we have the clear nature of mind that's able to reflect objects. Right? So the imputation is when the object arises on that clarity. Right? It's been added to the clarity. That's the conception. That's a conceptual thing. Then we give it the name. That's another added on bit. So the object, you know, like appears to mind, to a conceptual consciousness. The thing itself, the appearance, is not dependent upon causes and conditions. It's like, you know, it doesn't disintegrate momentarily.
So Eddie, I'm looking at this picture of the house and thinking about just recently in the bushfires when that Binnaburra Lodge burnt down, and how, you know, there was the loss of that historical lodge, but there was also underneath that a real shock that something important could disintegrate.
Well, if you look at this picture here, this is what I do. I ask myself, when I see that picture there, the house is already there. The picture of the house is right there. The causes for it aren't there, neither are the conditions for supporting it. It's just the house. And so there is the appearance right there of inherent existence. It's existing without causes and conditions. Of course, we know there are causes and conditions that produce it, but that's not what's appearing to us. Their effect is appearing to us, the thing called a house. So it's like a, you know, an image of a house without causes and conditions. So there we have, you know, a truly established house. You know, so look, we can look at houses, rainbows and clouds, and then we should always apply it back to ourselves and go, okay, what about me? Yeah. So there is an I or a self that is reborn within samsara. This I is a produced phenomena because its existence depends upon causes and conditions. Now, such as its previous continuum and karma, it also depends upon mum and dad, because the I depends upon, like, desire, ignorance, all sorts of different things. But here it's saying previous continuum karma. There are many, many different things it depends on. Now, if we search for an I within our body and mind or separate from them, we can't find one. So instead of a truly existent I appearing to our mind, a space-like emptiness appears. And what we need to do, we just rest that mind on that space like emptiness. And it's actually called space like meditative equipoise on emptiness. We see that there's no I there. It appeared that we thought there was one, because it appears to be, you know, truly existent. But it's not, because it depends upon causes and conditions. We look amongst the causes and conditions, we don't find an I there. An emptiness appears. We rest the mind there. So these are ways of getting at the emptiness of ourselves as truly existent people. Here we look at the extreme of singularity. So we put up a single tree. When we observe one object, we strongly feel that it is a single, indivisible entity. And due to our familiarity with self-grasping ignorance, we grasp its singularity to be inherently established. And this is grasping at the extreme of singularity. But in reality, our I, a sense of self or a tree, has many parts. Now the tree has got parts, a trunk, branches, leaves, roots, all sorts of things, right? The person has parts that look, listen, walk, and think. All the parts that are, for example, a teacher, a mother, a daughter, a wife. So our I is imputed onto the collection of all those parts. It's all called I. As with each individual phenomena, it is a singularity. But its singularity is merely imputed. Like a forest that's imputed onto a collection of trees, or an army that's imputed onto a collection of soldiers. Or here, tree, imputed onto a collection of trunk, branches, leaves. Or person, we see a single person, we grasp it as being singular, but they could be our mother, they could be a teacher, they have arms, legs, there's all these different parts. Right? But like I say, when we see one, we grasp it as one. So once again, this is the extreme of singularity, that singular things can appear to be inherently established and we grasp them to be that way.
So Eddie, just with that one, the extreme of singularity, yeah. We tend to do that all the time, and that's also, we rankle against it, because if we get a diagnosis of this or that, then we don't want to be labelled. We don't want to be put in a box.
That's right. So we're grasping at the label to be a singular thing. That's right.
Yeah. Okay.
Yep. That's right. Yeah, we don't like, we like it when it's good, but we don't like it when it's bad. Yeah. You know, it's like that, you know, so, you know, we say, he or she is marvelous. It's the singularity imputed to the person, right? But then somebody will say, yeah, but have you ever seen her when she's hungry? She's a horror. Or they'll talk about something else. You know, then suddenly, not only are they marvelous, but now they're not, they're all sorts of other things. And all those other things are the parts that make up the person. But like I say, when you see one part and you impute a name to it, it's a singularity. But the object is made up of all parts. So every object's like that. Now we come to this, another interesting one, the extreme of plurality. So we observe more than one object, and then we regard the multiplicity of those objects to be inherently established. Once again, due to our familiarity with self-grasping ignorance, we grasp the plurality to be inherently established. And this is grasping at the extreme of plurality. So here it says, just as a singularity is merely imputed, with the last slide, likewise, plurality is just an imputation by mind and does not exist from the side of the object. For example, instead of looking at a collection of soldiers or trees, from the point of view of the individual soldiers or trees, we could look at them as an army or a forest. That is, as a singular collection or whole, in which case we would now be looking at a singularity rather than a plurality. So plurality does not exist from its own side, because it's just imputed upon a singularity, the collection of parts.
So Eddie, is this where, say, nationalism comes into it, where people, you know, talk about Australian values or...
Yeah, that's right. That's it. So then we're talking, yeah, that's right, hun. It's just like that.
And then when someone tries to pin down exactly what are Australian values...
Yeah, that's right. Then you've got a couple of Australians. Yeah, they're all different. And then we've got these values, and then they apply all differently. So there's no sort of...
And what if Germans have the same values as us, then?
Yeah, that's right. So here it says, you know, we tend to project the faults or the qualities of the few onto the many. And then we develop hatred or attachment based on, for example, a gender, race, religion, or country. Contemplating the emptiness of singularity and the emptiness of plurality can be helpful in reducing hatred and attachment. So here I've just made a little note thing to remember. Singularity does not exist from its own side, because it's just imputed upon a group of parts, a plurality. Now, plurality does not exist from its own side, because it's just imputed upon the singularity, the collection of its parts. So they are free from the extreme of existence. And any type of conception one that grasps at these to truly exist is a wrong awareness. You know, so just like you said, if you say, marketers, advertisers, good politicians, I think, know this. So they will always put out this idea of the plurality, and when it suits them, the singularity. And we will grasp at it, because that's what we do. The mind will grasp that to be true. But then, like one of the students pointed out before, you know, we have different opinions. And so then we argue, but it's not true. And yeah, it's not truly existent. Lama Tsongkhapa says, appearances clear away the extreme of existence, and voidness clears away the extreme of non-existence. When you understand the arising of cause and effect from the viewpoint of voidness or emptiness, you are not captivated by either extreme view. So really this is getting at how important it is, first of all, to understand what is meant by empty. You know? And then we've got to come back and find, you know, this term empty of inherent existence. So this is saying, you know, we've got the extreme of existence. So appearances are arising all the time for us. So when they do, we should know that these appearances are not inherently existent. That's the extreme of existence, right? We have to understand they're not existing out there, independent of everything. This is this understanding. If you can get certainty in this, this emptiness, then that'll clear away the extreme that they don't exist whatsoever. Which is quite strange, because the normal way of presenting it, this is Lama Tsongkhapa's way of presenting it, which is quite special. The normal way is appearances clear away the extreme of existence, meaning non-existence. When you see something, it can't not exist because it exists. You're dealing with it. Right? And then emptiness clears away the extreme of inherent existence. That's the normal way that it's presented and the very easy way to understand it. But here Lama Tsongkhapa has also pointed out something else about it.
Yeah, it's very, very gone a whole layer deeper.
That's right. So in brief, this whole teaching is about what we call, you know, maintaining purity. And you know, this purity can come about through not using the mind, not, you know, this mind that has the intention to become enlightened for others, have it grasp it phenomena to be true. You know, we don't want it to grasp it and Buddhahood to inherently exist. We don't want to grasp it, the Buddha nature that all beings have, to inherently exist. We don't want to grasp it, anything inherently exist. Yet we also know that, you know, our minds are conventional cognizers. Everything that appears to it looks inherently existent. We have to acknowledge that and go, that's just like an illusion. Illusions appear real, but they're not. People appear truly existent, inherently existent, but they're not. That's an illusion. They're not within their body or mind, and they are not the body and mind. That's an illusion. So we cultivate insight into that, and through that, abandon attachment and aversion and so forth. It's related to bodhicitta, and especially related to the perfection of wisdom. Whew! So, we've looked at this, the shortcomings of attachment, selfish affection, taking heaviness as a path, and maintaining purity. And we've got a little bit over time. Have a look at this material here, pages 13 to 15 on transforming problems, the FPMT, 23 to 29, transforming problems, same text. The transforming problems assessment is very interesting to look at and see what you can apply to. And lastly, page 1 on transforming problems, attachment, anger by Khinsa Rinpoche, Geshe Tashi Sering. So we've come to the end. I know it's been probably pretty full on, but I hope you've enjoyed it.
I think it's been a spectacular class, and Eddie, now that the thunderstorm's coming along, the thunder's just rumbling in the background. Somehow it's very fitting.
Yeah, waking us up to the empty nature of appearances. Thunder also is a terrific metaphor for emptiness. Actually, they call it, you know, the roar of wisdom, using thunder as a metaphor for the roar of wisdom, the empty nature of all phenomena. The sound is a wonderful metaphor for acknowledging the emptiness of all phenomena. Do you guys have anything else you'd like to say or any questions you'd like to offer up?
No, just a slight worry about the unstable internet because of the thunderstorm.
Okay, well, let's dedicate then. So for all of you, thank you for being here. Let's dedicate for all of us to attain enlightenment for the benefit of others. And then also dedicate for our teachers and for all sentient beings. Wherever the spine of enlightenment has not grown, may it grow. And wherever it has never arrived, may it arrive and flourish. And when we adopt the spine as our way of being in the world and realize the empty nature of all phenomena. So thank you, everybody. And see you next week. Okay, and see you, Ian. Good to see you, mate.
Let's see, Chris left at the end of the call.
Hi, Alison, Bev. Not many left. Ben and Pauline, thank you for your contributions. Always welcome. Thank you, thank you. I'll see you next week, eh? Okay, bye-bye then.
One more week to go.
Okay.